fine slate and noticed that the windows glinted with glass.
We can't stay here. It'll cost a fortune.
Jill, my miserly turtle dove. The Girthin shook his head in mock sadness. If so, I shall earn a fortune in the tavern room to pay for it. I cannot stand cheap inns. They stink, and the mattresses are crawling with bugs. If I wanted to sleep on a floor, I would have been born a hound.
Well, but there's plenty of decent inns that cost less.
Why cavil over a few silvers? Besides, someone is meeting us here. As they led their horses up to the gates, a burly young man strolled out. He glanced with some appreciation at Salamander's beautifully woven cloak and gold-trimmed horse gear, then bowed.
Is this Silver Dagger with you, sir?
He is, my bodyguard. Have you a chamber on the second floor?
We do. I'll just call the lad to tend to your horses, sir.
Splendid. The first things we shall want are baths. But they had to postpone this by now necessary luxury for some time. When Jill followed Salamander into the tavern room, which had bardic carpets on the floor and silver sconces on the walls, she saw a tall man in the plaid brigger of the noble-born, pacing back and forth near the hearth. The sight of him wrung her heart, because Blaine looked so much like her Rodri.
"That's Squirebret Blaine," she said.
"Of course, he's the one who's meeting us here."
"He doesn't know about, well, about Perrin, does he?"
"Of course not. Don't you think I have any respect for your honour? Leave that part of this to me." As they walked over, Blaine saw them and strode to meet them. Although Salamander made him a courtly bow, he barely returned it, instead catching Jill's hand and giving it a hard squeeze.
"It gladdens my heart to see you, Jill, though it'd gladden it more if Rodri were with you."
He looked around and found the tavernman staring gape-mouthed at the sight of the Gwerbret greeting a Silver Dagger as an old friend.
"Innkeep, send up a flagon of your best mead to their chambers, and a plate of cold meats, too."
The chambers justified Jill's worst fears about expense. Not only were they carpeted, but all the furniture was beautifully polished wood, as heavily carved with interlace as anything in a lord's done. The flagon and the plate, both silver, arrived promptly. Blaine handed the servant lass coins worth twice what the refreshments cost, and dismissed her peremptorily.
"Now,"
said the Gwerbret, pouring himself a gobletful.
"Lord Maddox told me, Girthin, that you know how to do more things than spin tails, so you can speak freely. Do you know where Rodri is?"
"Almost to Caermore. In fact..." He paused to glance out the window to check the sun.
"I'd say he's in Caermore at the moment. But why is he there?"
"That, alas, I cannot see, Your Grace."
"No more can anyone, apparently. Curse them all."
Blaine glanced at Jill.
"Pour yourself some mead, Silver Dagger. You've had quite a journey. By the way, Jill, how did Rodri come to leave you behind?"
"Ah, Your Grace, that's a strange tale indeed," Salamander broke in smoothly. "Rodri was on a hire in Caergonny, you see.
I've heard summat about Benwick and his unlovely kin."
"Well and good, then. Well, Rodri had left Jill at the dun of a certain Lord Neth, the man he rode for, but he never came back for her. Fortunately, I came along. I'd been looking for her for reasons of my own, you see. I scried Rodri out and found him riding south. I refuse to believe that he simply deserted her."
"No more do I."
Blaine pledged her with his goblet.
"Don't think that for a moment, lass."
Jill forced out a brave smile.
"So, after much thought, brooding, and ratiocination, I arrived at the conclusion that someone, for reasons most recondite and unknown, was luring Rodri south. We have a hint or two that he was told that Jill had left him and was coming after her. Be that as it may, he's been acting like a hunted man all the way south from Luke Carn, while before that he travelled openly. Either summat happened to him in Luke Carn, or someone told him a falsehood of some sort."
"That would stand to reason, truly." Blaine sighed and drank heavily.
"I'll wager this has summat to do with the situation in Aberwyn. You know Rodri has enemies, don't you?"
"We do, Your Grace. Has the King made a decision as yet about a recall?" Jill turned away and busied herself with pouring a goblet of mead.
She wished that she could simply drink herself into forgetting that Rodri was being taken away from her.
Jill, Blaine said, you look heartsick.
Why shouldn't I be, Your Grace? I'm losing my man. Do you think they'll let Rodri marry a woman like me?
I see no reason why not, once I've done ennobling you. I'm settling land in your name over in Quimpeckle. The gods all know that there's plenty to spare in my province.
Your Grace!
Jill could barely speak.
You're far too generous. How can I...
Hush. Listen, Jill. Rodri's no weak younger son any longer. Once we get him recalled, he'll be Aberwyn's only heir, and that means he'll be the Guerbret when his black-hearted brother dies. He'll be in a position to demand the wife he wants, no matter what his mother or the rest of the noble-born think of it.
Salamander laughed.
And there you are, my turtle dove, an ending exactly like one of my tales. So it seems.
Jill smiled because they both wanted her to be pleased, but she felt the Dwayoma cold down her back. When Blaine launched into a monologue on Eldith politics, she wandered away to the window and looked down on the garden below. Salamander had told Blaine a pretty tale, sure enough. She could see how it would protect her. If Rodri wanted nothing more to do with her, everyone would assume that he'd merely tired of her and left, as men so often did to their women. And if he forgave her, the thought staggered her, that she, of all lowly commoners, might someday be the wife of a great Guerbret. For a moment she was terrified, thinking of the responsibilities, the power that could be hers.
Levian would teach me, she thought. If Rodri even wants me any more, that is.
But as the thought came to her, so did another, or not precisely a thought, a feeling rather, a sudden urgency. Rodri was in danger. She knew it with complete clarity that he was in the worst danger of his life, and that in this moment of danger he was thinking only of her. She shut her eyes and thought back to him, tried desperately to reach him, to warn him. Images flickered in her mind, as hazy as those seen when a person is first falling asleep, ever-changing glimpses. Rodri on a narrow street, Rodri ducking down an alley when some of the city wardens strolled by. Although the images flickered, the feeling of danger grew until she could barely breathe. He was talking with someone. He was asking about Nevin, asking about her. They were lying, saying that she was in Caermore, giving him friendly directions.
Rodri, don't go!
She heard a crash, looked around, dazed, and realized that she'd dropped the goblet she was holding. Blaine and Salamander had whirled round to look at her. She had screamed her warning aloud.
What, by the gods? Blaine said.
Rodri's in Caermore. He's in danger. I know he is. I saw. I felt it. I tried to warn him.
She tossed back her head and sobbed, because she knew that the warning had never reached him.
We've got to get to Caermore. We've got to leave now.
Blaine set down his goblet and hurried over to pat her shoulder awkwardly as she wept, as if he thought her mind turned weak and childish by grief. But Salamander was taking her warning in dead seriousness. Through her tears she saw him snap his fingers over the charcoal brazier in the corner, then stare intently into the lambent flames. She forced the tears back and wiped her face on her sleeve.
Ah, ye gods!
There was panic in his voice.
I can't find him. Jill, I can't scry him out.
The chamber seemed to swell around her, and the light grew painfully bright. The silver flagon on the table threw off sparks like a fire.
Call to Nevin!
She said. Then Blaine grabbed her and half led, half shoved her into a chair. She slumped back and watched Salamander, bending over the brazier. His tunic seemed to ripple around him as if he stood in a breeze. She was afraid to look at the intricate carpets.
Jill, do you need a chirurgeon? Blaine said.
I don't, my thanks. It's just the fear.
She forced herself to raise her head and look him in the face.
Your Grace... Don't you see what this means? Remember Alastair. If Salamander can't scry Rodri out, someone's hiding him with Dwayoma.
As it danced over the flames, Salamander's image looked close to tears. Nevin himself felt a weary sort of rage, cursing himself because he should have seen this danger coming. Had the Lords of Light sent some omen that he'd overlooked? He quite simply didn't know.
I can't find him either,
Nevin thought. Is he dead, then?
He can't be, because Jill would know if he were. When you consider how much she saw of his danger, I think we can trust that she'd feel his death. How soon can you get to Caremore?
We should arrive tomorrow.
Ye gods, what are you going to do? Turn into birds and fly?
Naught of the sort, truly. Salamander managed a faint smile. The king has placed one of the royal riverboats at Blaine's disposal. We'll leave soon, and not only will the current be running our way, but we'll have a crew of rowers. The Believer runs cursed fast from here to Drowthbury, I'm told.
Splendid. Is Blaine going with you?
He's not. The intrigue at court would gripe your very soul, and he doesn't dare leave. We have letters from him, though, for the Gwerbret in Caremore. Are you going to join us there?
I'll leave at once. I never dreamt that they would go as far as this. Can't you see what must have happened? Rodri's rivals must have hired one of the Bardic blood guilds to dispose of him.
Salamander's image, floating above the fire, looked intensely puzzled. How would petty lords from Eldeth even know those guilds exist?
Well, some merchant or other must have told them, or... I see what you mean. It sounds very far-fetched once I say it aloud.
Then what's happened?
What indeed? Be very careful until I reach Caremore. Ye gods, I'll have to take a ship. I can't speak until I've spoken with Levian, of course, but I can start packing. Her Grace is out hunting with the Gwerbret at the moment.
Down on the Eldeth coast, it was a bright sunny day, although the wind that whipped the silver and blue banners of Aberwyn was chilly, and the shadows that lay in the great ward of the Gwerbret's Dun were positively cold. As she stood beside her horse, Lady Levian glanced doubtfully at the sky.
"Oh, let's try our luck, Mother," Rhys said.
He spoke with such forced cheer that she knew this hunting party was merely an excuse to speak with her alone.
"By all means, then. We'll have a good ride, if naught else."
They mounted and rode out of the dun into the streets of Aberwyn. Behind them came the falconers, with the hooded birds on their wrists, and the four men from Rhys's warband as an escort. As they wound their way through the curving streets, the common folk bowed to their overlord, who acknowledged the gesture with an upraised hand. Occasionally, and quite spontaneously, boys and young men cheered him. For all his stubbornness, Rhys was a good ruler, scrupulously fair in his judgments over everyone but his younger brother, and his townsfolk appreciated him for it. When they left the city, they turned north on the river road that followed the Gwyn, sparkling and full from the summer's heavy rains. Among the willows and hazels that grew along the water, Levian saw a tree or two that were turning yellow.
"It seems that autumn's coming quite fast this year," she remarked.
"It does. Well, we've had a wretchedly cold summer." Rhys turned in his saddle to make sure that his men were following at a respectfully far distance behind, then turned her way.
"Here, Mother. I've got summat to ask you. It's about little Rother."
"Indeed?"
"I was thinking that I might formally adopt the child and legitimize her."
Levian was caught with nothing to say. Rhys gave her an ironic smile that must have cost him dear.
"It's time I face the harsh truth of things. I'll never give Aberwyn an heir."
"The Gwerbretrin can't pass down in the female line."
"Of course not. But she'll marry some day, won't she? Have a husband, maybe a son or two. At least they'll have some male with blood in them."
"If the Council of Electors accepted her husband as your successor, anyway."
"There's precedent for it. Hundreds of years of precedent."
He tossed his head in anger.
"Besides, at least it'll give my vassals pause. Ye gods, don't you think it aches my heart? I know cursed well that every tyrant in Eldeth is already scheming and politicking to get my lands for their son when I die."
"True spoken, alas. But you know, my sweet, there's a much easier solution."
"I will not recall Rodri."
His mouth settled into the tight line she knew so well.
"As His Grace decides, of course. But how can you adopt the child without her father's permission?"
"Rodri's an outlaw. Under the law, she has no father."
"Very well, then. I'll think the matter over. Since His Grace persists in being as stubborn as a wild boar."
He merely shrugged the insult away and went back to watching the road in front of him. Levian wondered why she even bothered to hint, scheme and badger to get her youngest son home. Rhys simply couldn't bear to let Rodri inherit, she thought. Now if Rodri would only get a son on that Jill of his. But there she is, poor lamb, riding all over with him, and sleeping out in the rain on the ground, and the goddess only knows what else. Doubtless her womanly humours are utterly disrupted, and... Suddenly Rhys's horse went mad. Levian could think of it no other way as the black neighed and bucked, then reared, striking out with its forehooves as if at an enemy. Rhys flew forward, caught himself on its neck, then slipped sideways as it bucked again. Although he was a splendid rider, the horse was rearing and pitching in utter panic, and he'd been taken off guard. She heard his men shouting, heard other hoofbeats, but Rhys's black twisted, bucked, then slipped and went down, throwing Rhys hard and falling on top of him. She heard a woman screaming, then realized that the voice was hers. Suddenly the escort was all around her. One man grabbed the bridle of her frightened palfrey and led her away. The others dismounted and rushed to their lord's side. Back under control, Levian gestured at the man holding her horse.
"Ride back to the dun. Bring Nevin and a cart." "My lady."
He made her a half-bow from the saddle, then galloped off. Levian dismounted and hurried over, just as the horse struggled to its feet, its off-fore dangling and broken. One of the riders blocked her way.
"My lady, you'd best not look."
"Don't speak nonsense. I've tended my share of wounds in my day."
She shoved him aside and knelt down beside Rhys. He lay so still that at first she thought him dead, but when she touched his cheek, his eyes fluttered open. His face twisted in agony as he tried to speak.
"Whist, whist, little one. We'll have Nevin here soon."
He nodded, then stared up at the sky, his mouth working in pain. Blood ran down his face from a slash over his eye. She could see that his left leg was broken, probably in several places. Yet she knew that the worst damage might have been done internally, where no chirurgeon could heal, not even Nevin. She could only pray to the goddess, until at last the old man rode up at the gallop, with a wagon rumbling after. Nevin swung himself down from his horse and ran over.
"Does he live?"
"Barely."
Levian got out of the way and stood with the escort by the side of the road as Nevin went to work, straightening the leg and roughly splinting it. As he ran his long, graceful hands over Rhys's body, she saw him shaking his head and swearing under his breath, and her heart turned cold. At last, Nevin called the carter to help him lift the injured Gwerbret into the wagon. By then, Rhys had mercifully fainted. Levian got in with him and cradled his bloody head in her lap. Nevin watched, his ice-blue eyes unreadable.
"I want the cold truth," Levian said. "Will he die?"
"Well, my lady, I simply don't know. His grace is a truly strong man, and he'll fight for his life. But it's very grave. A weaker man will be dead already."
To jostle the injured man as little as possible, they rode slowly back to Aber Wyn. Over and over, Levian saw the accident in her mind. Why did the horse panic? There wasn't so much as a mouse running across the road. It had happened like Dweoma. Suddenly she went cold all over and called out to Nevin, who was riding a little behind. He urged his horse up to ride beside the cart.
"Nevin, this accident was a most peculiar one."
"The man you sent to fetch me said as much, my lady. May I suggest that we discuss it privately?"
"Of course."
She felt her fear like a hand at her throat. The old man apparently agreed with her sudden insight. Rhys's wife, Madrona, met them at the gates. A willowy blonde woman, she was pretty in a vacuous sort of way, but now her childlike face was composed by an iron will. Levian had to admire her daughter-in-law, who was sincerely fond of her husband.
"His chamber's prepared," Madrona said. "How bad is..."
"Bad, truly, but not the end. We'll nurse him through this between us."
While the men carried Rhys to the chamber, Levian went to her suite, took off her blood-soaked dress, and washed thoroughly. She put on a clean dress, a somber one of grey linen, then looked at herself in a mirror. The face that looked back seemed to have aged years since the morning. She was painfully aware of the deep wrinkles slashed across her cheeks and the numb, half-dead look of her eyes.
Ah, goddess, am I to bury another son?
She laid the mirror down and turned away, knowing that she would do just that, for all Nevin's skill with his herbs. Yet she could not cry. She found herself remembering the day her second son was brought home to her. Her gentle Adri, just 16 that summer, brought home wrapped in a blanket and tied over his horse, killed riding with his father in a war. She stood in the ward and watched while they cut the ropes and brought him down, and she never allowed herself one tear, because she knew the warband was watching, and if she cried at all, she would start screaming like a madwoman. She felt the same now. No matter how furious Rhys made her, he was still her firstborn son. With a toss of her head, she left the chamber and went down to the great hall. Over on the rider's side, the men were drinking steadily and saying little, even the 10 men of her own that she'd brought as escort. As she walked past, she motioned to her captain, Cullen of Caermore. He hurried over to the honour table and knelt at her side.
"Will he live, my lady?"
"I can only hope so, captain. I need to send a speeded courier to Dundevery. The king has to be informed of this. Pick the man you think best, and get him ready to go."
"Done, my lady. But it had best be one of Rhys's men."
"For the formality, I suppose you're right, but I can't command them."
"But, my lady, you're the regent here now."
"Oh, by the gods, so I am. It's all happened so fast that I can barely think."
"It would take anyone that way, my lady."
He hesitated, honestly sympathetic, but bound by considerations of rank. Finally, he spoke again.
"Your Grace, you know that I've had my differences with the Gwerbret in the past, but it aches my heart to see your grief."
"My thanks."
When he looked up, she suddenly remembered Rhodri and what Rhys's death might mean. The battle-grim warrior kneeling beside her loved Rhodri like a son, and she knew that Cullen was as torn as she was. If Rhys died, even if he merely lay ill for months, the king would have the perfect reason to recall his brother, and Rhys would be unable to say a word in protest. She wanted Rhodri home with all her heart, but to have it take this...
"Ah, gods!"
Her voice sounded like a moan, even to her, and she forced herself to stay in control of her rising tears.
"Captain, fetch me a scribe and the captain of Rhys's warband. We've got to get that message to Dundevery as soon as ever we can."
For hours, Nevin worked on the injured Gwerbret, but even as he set the broken leg and stitched the bad cut over the eye, he felt his hope receding. Sooner rather than later, Rhys would die. The fall had damaged one of his lungs. Nevin could hear that by putting his ear to the Gwerbret's chest, but how badly he couldn't know. The one good sign was that Rhys was not spitting up blood, which would mean that the lung had been punctured by a splinter from one of his many broken ribs. In time it might heal, though he doubted it. What was worse was the damage to his kidneys. By opening up his second sight, Nevin could see the Gwerbret's aura, and in it the centres of the various vortices of etheric force that correspond to the major organs of the body. Although such a diagnosis was rough, he could tell that something was severely wrong internally, centred on the kidneys. Just how severe, again, he couldn't say. He knew that time would make it all horribly clear. Finally, he'd done what he could do. Propped up on pillows, Rhys lay gasping for every breath he drew on the enormous bed with its blue and silver hangings, worked all over with the dragon symbol of the Ran. His raven dark hair was plastered to his forehead with sweat, and when he opened his eyes, they were cloudy.
"Will I live?" "That depends on you to a large degree, Your Grace. Are you going to fight to live?"
Rhys smiled as if saying that the question was superfluous, then fainted. With a sigh, Nevin went to the chamber door to let in his wife, who had patiently waited all the long hours. She gave him a tremulous smile, then ran to her husband's side.
"If he looks the least bit worse, send a page for me immediately, my lady. I'm going down to the great hall to eat."
I will, good herdman. My thanks.
Nevin came into a somber hall. The warbands ate silently. The servants moved among them without saying a word. Alone at the head of the honour table, Levian was picking at a bit of roast fowl, eating a bite, then laying her table dagger down and staring into space. He sat down at her right hand.
You should try to eat, Your Grace.
Of course, but everything tastes like dirt from the stable yard. I've sent a messenger off to Dun Guerbrin to fetch my serving women. I rather feel the need of them.
Just so. As regent, you'll have much serious business to attend to.
A servant came with a trencher of fowl and cabbage, as well as a tankard of ale. Hoping he wouldn't offend Levian, Nevin set to. He was hungry after his hard afternoon's work. She choked down a bit of bread like a dutiful child.
I also sent a speeded courier to Dundevery, she remarked. He'll go by ship to Caermore, then ride from there.
Good. But truly, I think I'll send a message of my own. The king needs to know of this before... as soon as possible. My messages travel faster than horses.
No doubt.
She shuddered like a wet dog.
Tell me the truth, my friend. When you slipped and said, before, you meant before Rhys dies, didn't you?
I'm afraid I did. My apologies. It may take weeks, but...
She nodded, staring at her trencher, then suddenly pushed it away. Although she seemed on the verge of tears, she tossed her head and sat up straight, looking at him steadily.
"Let's lie to his poor little wife," she said. "Let her have a bit of hope. It's hard to be widowed when you've only been a wife for a year."
"So it is, and I agree. Besides, the gods may intervene and let him live. I've seen one or two cases where I've given up hope, only to have the patient recover."
"Well and good, then."
Yet her weary voice implied that such a hope was one that she would deny herself.
"And what of that accident? There wasn't even a fly buzzing round his horse."
"So I thought, from what your messenger told me."
He hesitated, wondering how much to say.
"I'm not truly sure what happened, but I've made a few guesses. I suppose that poor beast was put out of its misery."
"It was. The riders told me that it would have been in agony the whole way back to the dun, so they slit its throat and gave the meat to a nearby farmer."
"Well, I doubt if it could have told me much anyway."
"Here, can you speak with animals?"
"Not in the least, my lady, I assure you, but I might have done a thing or two and judged its reactions. Well, as I say, doubtless naught would have come of it anyway. Here's what I've been thinking. Most animals have what men call the second sight, that is, they can see the wild folk and a few kinds of apparitions. It's possible that the horse was frightened by malicious wild folk, or by some sort of vision."
"A vision? A ghost or such like?"
"Or such like. There's never been a report of a ghost or banshee along the river road before, and they're generally tied to one place."
"I've never heard reports of any other sort of vision along that road either."
"Just so. I think we can conclude that the vision, or the wild folk, or whatever it was deliberately sent there."
"Sent?"
Her face went very pale.
"Just that, my lady. I'll wager that someone used Dwayoma to try and murder your son. When I find out who he is, then I swear to you he'll rue the day he was born."
"My thanks."
Although she spoke in a whisper, she was calm, the cold, bitter calm of a warrior surveying the field.
"You told me that there was evil Dwayoma working behind Lord Corbin when he rebelled. I never thought to see a blood feud worked by Dwayoma. But that's what this must be, isn't it? First they try to kill Rodri, and now they've succeeded with Rhys. For some reason they hate the Maelwyth clan."
"Ye gods, you're right enough, and Rodri is—"
He caught himself barely in time. There was no need to burden her with the truth at this particular moment.
"Out somewhere on the roads. Well, doubtless the king's men will find him soon. The gods all know that they have more reason than ever to look for him."
Levian nodded, staring blindly down at her plate. Nevin got up and went to the fire.
He had to tell Salamander immediately that he could no longer come to Caremore. He would have to do his best to keep Rhys alive until the king made up his mind to recall Rodri and instate him as Aberwyn's heir. He had another piece of information to pass along too. The grim truth that Levian had seen, that the matter had gone far beyond the politicking of Eldith lords. The Dark Dwayomer was waging war on the Melwith clan. The king was having his hair bleached. In the midst of his private chamber, Lalin II, High King of Aldaveri and Eldith, sat on a low bench carved with grappling wyverns, while the royal barber draped towels around his liege's shoulders. As an honour to his high rank, Blaine was allowed to kneel at the king's side and hold the silver tray of implements. Ever since Madoc had come to him with the news, he'd been trying to have a private word with Lalin, but in all the pomp that surrounded the king, private words were difficult to get. Even though the king sincerely wanted to hear what he had to say, this was the first chance they'd found all evening. Carefully, the barber began packing the king's wet hair with lime from a wooden bowl. Soon Lalin would look like one of the great heroes of the dawn time, with a lion's mane of stiff swept-back hair to add further to his 6 feet of height. Such a hairstyle was a royal prerogative, and, as the king remarked, a royal nuisance too.
"Blasted lucky, aren't you, Blaine? Look on our sufferings and be glad you were born a Gwerbret son."
"Glad I am, my liege." The barber wrapped 2 steaming wet towels around the king's head and fastened them with a circlet of fine gold.
"My liege, it will be some few minutes."
"It's always more than just a few. You may leave us." Bowing, walking backward, the barber retreated to the corridor. Blaine sincerely hoped that the king was going to believe his strange tale.
"Now, Blaine, what's this urgent news?"
"Well, my liege, do you remember Lord Madoc?"
"The sorcerer's nephew, of course."
"Here. You know that Nevin's a sorcerer, my liege." Lalin grinned at him while he adjusted a slipping towel.
"I do at that. There's quite a tradition, passed down from king to marked prince, about sorcerers named Nevin. The name's something of an honorific, or so my father told me, handed on like the kingship. In times of great need, one Nevin or another will come to aid the king. I always thought it a peculiar tale, and wondered why my father would tell me such a lie, until those gems were stolen, and lo and behold, a Nevin appeared to return them to me. I prayed to my father in the other lands and made my apologies quite promptly, I tell you."
"I see. Oh, well then, I trust my liege will believe me when I tell him that Madoc has Dwayomer too."
"Ah, I thought so, but I wasn't sure. I'm glad enough to know. But is this what you had to tell me?"
"Not at all, my liege. I have learned that Dwayomer men have ways of sending messages with their thoughts. Madoc came to me earlier with urgent news from Nevin. He begged me to tell you because he knew it would be difficult for a man of his rank to gain a private audience with the king, and this has to be kept private for as long as possible. Soon the whole court will know, because a speeded courier's on the way from Aberwyn, but Nevin wanted your highness to get the news first."
"I see. And what is this grave matter?"
"Rhys of Aberwyn had a bad fall in a hunting accident today, my liege. They doubt if he'll live long. An 8-night, perhaps. At the most, a month."
The king stared at him for a moment, then swore in a way more fitting for a common-born rider than royalty.
"I agree, my liege. You can see why I thought it best that my liege heard this news straight away."
"Just so." The king gingerly settled a slipping towel while he thought things over. "And I'm most grateful to you for it. Eldith politics are always dangerous."
"So they are. No doubt my liege needs no reminding that the line of succession in Aberwyn will break as soon as Rhys dies."
"No doubt. I'm also quite aware of how much your exiled cousin means to you, Your Grace. Rest assured that the matter is under my consideration." Blaine felt the formal tone of voice like a slap across the face. He was being reminded that no matter how often they hunted or drank together, no matter how easily Lalin would jest with him when the mood took him, the king was as far above him as he was above the common folk.
"My humble thanks, my liege. Your consideration is all that I'd ever ask for in this matter."
The king nodded with a glance away. "Tell the barber that he can come back, will you? I want these towels off, and now I have some serious thinking to do.
In spite of the king's return to a more familiar tone, Blaine knew that he'd been dismissed. As he rose and bowed, he was wondering just what Talith of Belglaith and his allies had been telling their liege.
"I know Blaine will take good care of him, but I hate to leave Sunrise behind," Jill said.
"Oh, come now, my turtle dove."
Salamander was busy tying shut his saddlebags.
"Every lad in the royal stables will be fussing over him, and with luck we won't be gone long."
"I doubt me if we're going to have that kind of luck."
He paused, turning to look at her. They were in the inn chamber with their packed gear strewn around them.
"Well, do you think..."
"I don't." He sighed elaborately. "I was merely trying to console."
There was a brief knocking at the door, and Blaine strode in without waiting for an invitation. With him were two serving lads, who immediately began gathering up the gear.
"The galley's ready," Blaine announced. "I'll accompany you down to the docks."
"His Grace is most kind."
Salamander made him a bow.
"And our liege the king as well."
"Indeed. I found out, or should I say my lady found out, exactly why Savile of Caminwayne is taking a hand in this affair. His younger brother has a slight claim to Aberwyn."
"Truly?" Jill said. "I never heard Lady Levian mention him."
"Well, it's not truly the sort of thing my aunt would dwell upon. You see, Rodri's father had two bastard daughters with a mistress of his. Savile's brother married one of them."
"Two daughters?"
Salamander broke in.
"Well, fancy that. Or, here, of course, you mean Gwerbret Tengar. And who else would I be meaning?"
Jill gave Salamander a subtle sideways kick.
"No one, Your Grace,"
Salamander covered smoothly. "I'd merely forgotten the Gwerbret's name."
"Ah, well, it's hard to keep all the noble bloodlines up in mind, truly. Here."
Blaine tossed Salamander an embroidered cloth pouch.
"Use this wisely."
Whistling under his breath, Salamander hefted the pouch and made it jingle.
"From the weight and the sound, Your Grace, there must be a cursed lot of gold in here. As much as I could raise. I intend to get it back from my scapegrace cousin once he's Aberwyn, mind."
Although he spoke casually, Jill could hear the tension in his voice, a wondering, perhaps, if he were bankrupting himself to little end. Once again she was overwhelmed by the sheer weight of ruling, the smothering web of obligations and intrigues that overlaid even something as fine as Blaine's and Rodri's love for each other. Salamander made the Gwerbret an exaggerated bow.
"We shall do our best to protect His Grace's investment."
Then he flicked his long fingers and made the pouch disappear, seemingly into nothingness. By then it was just sunset, and long shadows filled the curving streets. When they reached the wooden wharves to the south of the city, the sky had turned a velvet blue-grey with twilight. Over the grassy riverbanks, bold swallows swooped and twisted. Riding low in the water, some little way from the masses of barges and skiffs, was the royal galley, about 40 feet long and sleek as a ferret. There were red shields painted with the royal gold wyvern at every oarlock, and the men who lounged at the oars were wearing white shirts embroidered with the wyvern badge and long lines of interlace.
"The king's elite?"
Salamander raised an eyebrow.
"The same," Blaine said. "I can't tell you, though, if our liege is doing this for Rodri's sake or mine."
"Surely the king doesn't want to see Eldith at war," Salamander said. "Because if Rodri doesn't return, war is what we'll have. Each clan will be accusing the others of murdering the rightful heir and claiming the Ran for themselves. I'm sure our liege knows that as well as you do."
Yet Blaine sounded oddly stiff, a bit frightened, perhaps.
"I'm not privy to all his thoughts, Girthin."
At the sight of Blaine, the galley's captain hopped to the pier and hurried over with a bow. While the servants loaded the gear aboard, Jill turned away and watched the smooth-flowing river. Desperately, she tried to scry Rodri out, but her untrained mind could show her nothing. All at once, she felt another fear, and involuntarily yelped aloud.
"What is it?" Salamander said.
"Perrin! He's close by. I know it."
She spun around, half expecting to see him in the crowd behind them, but there was no one there but curious passers-by and a few longshoremen. Yet up in the velvet sky, it seemed to her that she saw a long tendril of mist reaching down toward her. Salamander saw it too. When he threw up one hand and muttered a few words, the tendril vanished.
"He's in town, all right. Maddock will be taking care of that, Jill. Don't worry about a thing."
"Still, can't we get on that wretched boat and get out of here?"
"This very minute. There's the captain signalling us aboard."
Perrin paused just inside the south gate of the city. Just a moment ago he'd felt Jill's nearness, now the trail had suddenly gone cold. His dapple grey stamped impatiently and tossed its head. When they'd ridden into the vast city earlier that afternoon, the grey had nearly panicked. It had taken all of Perrin's horse empathy to calm it, and even so it was still restless.
"Here, you! Are you going in or out? It's time to close the gates!"
Perrin turned to see two city guards hurrying toward him, one of them carrying a torch. The cavernous gateway was already quite dark.
Well, in, I think." "Then don't just think. Move, man."
As Perrin obediently began to lead his horses toward the inner gate, the guard carrying the torch raised it high to shine the light full on his face.
"Your name wouldn't be Lord Perrin of Alibri, would it now?"
"It is at that. Why?"
The torchbearer whistled sharply, three loud notes. The other guard grabbed Perrin's shoulder with his left hand and slammed his fist hard into his stomach, so quickly that Perrin had no time to dodge. He doubled over, retching, as two more guards ran up and grabbed his horse's reins from his helpless fingers.
"Good work. You got the weasel Lord Maddock wanted right enough. Talks like a simpleton, his lordship told me, and he must be one too to answer to his name like that."
Although the world still danced around him, Perrin forced himself to raise his head and look, in time to see a guard rummaging through his saddlebags. With a bark of triumph, he held up the rambling scribe. When Perrin made a feeble grab at it, another guard slapped him across the face.
"None of that, horse thief. The only thing this scribe's going to write for you now is your death writ."
They disarmed him, bound his hands behind him, then pushed him along through the streets. Those few people still out at night stopped to stare and jeer when the guards announced that he was a horse thief. At one point they met a slender young man, wearing the plaid brigger of the noble-born, who was followed by a page with a torch.
"A horse thief, is he?" the young lord said. "When will you be hanging him?"
"Don't know, my lord. We've got to have the trial first."
"True enough. Well, no doubt I'll hear of it. My mistress is quite keen on hangings, you see."
He gave the guard a conspiratorial wink.
"She finds them quite, well, shall we say, exciting. And so I take her to every single one."
At last they reached the guard station at the foot of the Royal Hill, and turned Perrin over to the men there, though the man who'd first recognised him stayed to escort him into the royal compound itself. By then, Perrin had recovered enough from the blows to feel the terror. They were going to hang him. There was no use lying to the king's officers. The rambling scribe would hang him on its own. Although at one point he did have a sentimental pang that he'd never see Jill again, at the root he was too terrified to care much about that one way or another. What counted was that he was going to die. No matter how hard he tried to pull himself together and face his death like a warrior, he kept trembling and sweating. When his guards noticed, they laughed.
"You should have thought about this rope when you were putting one on another man's horses, you cowardly little bastard. There must be a bit of fun to being hanged, lad. Why, a man gets hard, then spews all over himself when the noose jerks."
They kept up the jest the entire time that they were dragging him through the warren of sheds and outbuildings that surrounded the king's many-towered Brock complex. In the flickering torchlight, Perrin was completely disoriented. By the time they had shoved him into a tiny cell in a long stone building, he had no idea of which way north lay, much less of the layout of the palace grounds. The cell was about 8 feet on a side, with fairly clean straw on the floor, and a leather bucket swarming with flies in one corner. In the door was a small barred opening that let in a bit of light from the corridor. Perrin stood next to it and tried to hear what the guards were saying, but they moved down along the corridor and out of earshot.
he heard.
"Of course Lord Maddock's interested in horse thieves. He's an equerry, isn't he?"
before they were gone. All at once his legs went weak. He slumped down into the straw before he fell and covered his face with his hands. Somehow or other, he defended one of the powerful royal servitors. He was doomed. Perrin had no idea of how long he'd sat there before the door opened. A guard handed him a trencher with half a loaf of bread and a couple of slices of cold meat on it.
"Pity we had to take your dagger away, lad." His smile was not pleasant. "Just use your teeth like a wolf, eh? In the morning, one of the under-councillors will be along to see you."
"What for?"
"To tell you about your rights, of course. Here, they caught you red-handed, but you'll still get a trial, and you've got the right to have your kin by your side. Just tell the fellow, and he'll get a herald to them."
"I don't want them to know. Ah, ye gods, I'd rather die slowly in pieces and look my uncle in the eye over this."
"Pity you didn't think of that before, eh? Well, I'm sure it can all be arranged. If you don't want your kin here, no need to waste the herald's time."
The warder handed in a tankard of ale, then locked the door. Perrin heard him whistling as he walked away. Although the food and drink were unexpectedly decent, Perrin ate only to pass the time. The thought of Benwick and Nedd learning of his shame had taken his appetite away. Sooner or later they would, too, no matter whether they were there to watch him hang or not. He thought of the warder's words, that he might have thought of all this before, and wept a few tears for the truth of it.
"But I didn't really steal them. They followed me, didn't they?"
"Only in a manner of speaking."
He yelped and leapt to his feet, scattering the bread into the straw. There was a man standing on the other side of the door, a pleasant-looking fellow with blonde hair and blue eyes. The sheer bulk of the elaborate embroidery on his shirt proclaimed him a member of the king's household.
"I'm Lord Maddock. Guards, bring him out."
"Are you going to hang me right now?"
"Naught of the sort. I want a few words with you, lad."
They bound his hands and marched him along to the wardroom, a long narrow chamber with an oppressively low ceiling. Down one wall was a row of sconces and lit torches, down the other a narrow table spread with tools of the torturer's trade.
"I'll confess," Perrin bleated. "You don't have to do anything to me."
"Splendid, but I wasn't planning on having you tortured. I want to look at you. Guards, tie him to the wall, then you can get back to your dinners. My thanks, your lordship."
The guard captain made him a bow.
"Do you have any idea of when he'll go to trial?"
"Oh, he won't be tried here. Our liege is remanding him to Rhys, Gwerbret Aberwyn. This little idiot raped the daughter of one of the Gwerbret's highly regarded subjects, and under Eldith law, her father has the right to cut him to pieces."
Perrin's knees buckled. If he hadn't been tied to an iron ring attached to the wall, he would have fallen.
"Ha!" the captain snorted. "A fine figure of a noble lord he is, raping women and stealing horses."
Once the guards were gone, Maddock turned to Perrin and considered him with eyes so cold and distant that Perrin began to sweat again.
"Do you know who Jill's father is, lad?"
"I don't, my lord."
"Cullen of Caermore, that's who."
Perrin yelped, a strangled little sob.
"Just so. They'll give him a sword and shield, hand you a dagger to defend yourself, then turn him loose on you. Think you'll win the ritual combat?"
Perrin shook his head no.
"I doubt me as well. And even if you had all the gold in the world to offer as compensation, Cullen wouldn't take it instead of your blood. So, are you going to face him, or are you going to do as I say instead?"
"Anything, my lord. I'll do anything. Please, I never raped her. I truly didn't. I thought she loved me. I truly did."
"I know, and your stupidity is the one thing that's saving you now. If I untie you, will you give me your word of honour that you won't try to escape?"
"Gladly. I doubt me if I could run, my lord, the way I feel."
"No doubt."
He stepped back and considered him in a strange way, his eyes moving as if he were looking all around Perrin rather than at him.
"Truly, you're halfway to being dead, aren't you?"
The lord's words seemed true enough. As soon as he was untied, Perrin staggered and would have fallen if it weren't for Madoc's support. The equerry half-led, half-hauled him down the room to a low bench by a hearth, where some tinder and small sticks were laid ready for a fire. Madoc laid on a pair of logs, then snapped his fingers. Fire sprang out and danced along the wood. Perrin screamed. He clapped his hands over his mouth to force a second scream back, then swiveled around, crouching, to stare up at Madoc in terror.
"Well, you look chilled, lad. Thought we'd have a bit of a blaze. Now, you young dolt, do you see what you've gotten yourself tangled up in? From now on, you're going to do exactly what I say, or..."
"I will. Anything at all, my lord. I swear to you on the honour of the Wolf Clan and the gods of my people."
"Good. Remember that during your trip to Eldith."
"I'm going there. You said you wouldn't..."
"I said I wouldn't let Cullen get hold of you. There's another man there who very much wants a chat with you. My uncle."
3. In those days, Caermore had yet to expand to the place where the Guamail and the Bell Rivers meet. A small village, De Vere, stood there, some 40 houses and a pair of wooden docks, with a couple of inns to serve travellers who couldn't reach Caermore before nightfall. The royal galley put in there, ostensibly to buy ale, but in reality to set Jill ashore. Since Salamander had letters for the Guerbret, he would be marked at once as an important man in the city. Since she wanted to ask some questions of the kind of people who would have nothing to do with anyone associated with his grace and his wardens, she needed to ride in alone. Carrying the old saddle and bridle she'd brought from Dundevery for this purpose, and laden down with her gear too, she made a great show of limping and cursing as she came into the village, as if she'd had to walk a long way in her riding boots. When she reached the dusty open space that did duty as a town square, she saw a couple of idlers sitting in the shade of a willow tree.
"What happened, Silver Dagger? Lose your horse?"
"I did. Broke his leg about 5 miles north of here. Is there anyone in town who can sell me another? By the love of every god, I hope I never walk that far again."
Since horses were a luxury beyond their reach, the villagers laughed in a nasty sort of way, but one of them waved his hand southward.
"Try the big inn by the Caermore Road, lad. Old Matt sometimes has an extra horse or two in his stable."
"My thanks. By the way, have there been any other Silver Daggers through here recently? I'm looking for a friend of mine, an Eldith man he is, but I wouldn't know what name he's travelling under."
The two of them exchanged a brief look.
"Well, seeing as how you're another Silver Dagger and all, I don't suppose there's any harm in telling you. An Eldith man calling himself a Doric came through here 2 days ago. He had the dagger in his belt."
"What's he wanted for?" the second man chimed in.
"Cursed if I know. The Guerbret's men don't tell the likes of me their business."
Jill shrugged as best she could under all her burdens.
"Well, I'll be getting along. My back's breaking."
As she limped away, Jill was thinking that Rodri must have spread plenty of silver around on his ride south to keep local tongues mute. Even so, it was odd that no one who'd seen him had told the Guerbret's men the truth once the man who'd given them the coin had ridden on. It was probably the reputation of Silver Daggers that kept them honest, she supposed, the simple fear that Rodri or someone else would come back to slit their throats if they failed to keep the bargain. She found the inn and old Matt easily enough, and indeed he did have a horse for sale, a decent grey gelding with a white off-fore and a white blaze. She haggled long enough to be convincing, then paid over some of Blaine's coin and saddled up the gelding. They left the village at a quick walk-trot pace, but once they were well on the road, she let the gelding canter. In about an hour, not long before sunset, Jill reached the north gate of the city. Coming to Caermore always made her a bit melancholy. Since her parents had been born and raised there, she'd heard about it all her life, and it seemed that it should have been her home too. "Except that I have no home at all," she thought. Now she had even more reason to feel a total stranger, because Dwayoma was riding into town with her. With a bitter twist of her mouth, she realized that whether she fought against her own Dwayoma or not, it had already made her an alien among her people. It was also putting her in danger.
As she led her horse down the narrow twisting streets, through the packs of beggars and crowds of merchants and townsfolk, she was aware of how easy it would be for someone to slip up behind her and stick a dagger in her ribs. During her long walk down to the harbour, she constantly looked around and behind her. That was probably why she saw the old woman at all. Just as Jill crossed the market square, a wagon filled with hay for the Guerbrets' horses took a turn a little too sharply and tipped, blocking the street. Cursing, the carters picked themselves up off the cobbles as the strollers who had been right behind them milled in confusion, and a noble on horseback began yelling at everyone to get out of his way that very instant. Jill turned her horse around and started working her way back along the edge of the square. All at once she felt that she was being watched and spun around. Perched on a low wall with a market basket in her lap was a grey-haired woman wearing the black headscarf of a widow. Although much mended, her plain blue dress was clean, caught in by a precisely folded kirtle. She was staring at Jill so intensely that Jill laid her hand on her sword hilt without thinking. The old woman shrank back.
"My apologies, lad. You just remind me of someone I used to know, like."
"No offence, good dame." Up ahead, the crowd cleared and began to disperse. Jill hurried through the opening, then stopped cold. That voice, the old woman's voice, by the gods it had sounded familiar, but whose? Like her mother's. And the old woman had found her familiar in turn. Swearing under her breath, Jill got her horse turned around in the crowd and shoved her way back to the wall. The old woman was gone. Although she searched the area around the market square for some 20 minutes, she never caught another glimpse of the woman who might have been her grandmother. She felt her eyes fill with tears, irritably wiped them away, then headed down to the harbour. Rodri and the Dwayoma had to come before her and her kin. Immediately around the Kermor harbour, of course, was the area known as the Bilge, a tangle of narrow alleys, dirty shops, brothels and taverns, all catering to the sailors, or perhaps preying upon them would be the better said. As much as Jill needed the kind of information that the bilge could give her, she had no intention of spending a night there. A safe distance upriver, in a bleak but decent district of warehouses and longshoremen's cottages, was an inn called the Capstan that had a good reputation among Silver Daggers, or at least as good a reputation as any Silver Dagger inn could possibly have. Jill stabled her horse in a smelly, split-roof shed, while the bald, squint-eyed innkeep scratched himself as he watched without a move to help her.
"You're cursed young to have the dagger. What's it to you?"
Jill laid her hand on its hilt.
"Naught, naught. You can have a chamber to yourself if you like, lad. Custom slow this time of year."
"Done, then." The chamber was a tiny wedge of the second story, with warped shutters over the window and a mattress on the floor. When she kicked it out of the way, bedbugs swarmed and roiled. She dumped her gear in the corner, then left, padlocking the door behind her. The long, narrow tavern room was dark and smoky, but the tabletops and the straw on the floor were reasonably clean. Jill swaggered in, trying to look as masculine as she could, and got herself a tankard of dark. Sooner or later someone was bound to realise that she was a lass, but she preferred it to be later. Since it was right at the dinner hour, the tavern was crowded with sailors spending their wages, a couple of wenches to help them at it, travelling peddlers, and a sprinkling of indifferently dressed men who were most likely thieves. The tavernman pointed to the hearth where a stout woman fussed over a kettle.
"Beef stew tonight, Silver Dagger."
"Good." Jill saluted him with her tankard and strolled away, to stand with her back to the wall. She'd had only a few sips of ale when she heard someone yelling out in the inn yard. The tavernman ran to the window.
"Ye gods, it's some of the Guerbrets' men. They're coming here."
Several of the customers melted away out the back as a man in mail threw open the front door. Three swordsmen, all dressed in dark red brigger, marched in and collared the innkeep.
"Any more customers upstairs?" the leader said.
"Not that I know of. Here, what is all this?"
"We're looking for someone, that's all."
The swordsman turned to study the crowd.
"We've already swept the bilge. You can wager that we weren't entirely welcome, but sweep it we did. Here, you, Silver Dagger, get over here."
Jill walked over as slowly and as insolently as she dared.
"What's your name, lad?"
"Gillin. What's it to you?"
"Naught, scum, if that's the stance you're going to take." Do you know a man named Rodri of Aberwyn? He's a member of your band.
I do. Last time I saw him was up in Caer Gonny. What are you looking for him for?
Nought that concerns you.
He started to tell